"Something I have to tell you," she says. She feels almost short of breath. "I would have told you anyway," she swallows. "I swear I would have."
"Told me what?" Larry says.
He looks uneasy. She blurts it out, looking down at the floor. "I slept with Robert Pierce when you were away. They found out when they were investigating him about his wife." She finally brings her eyes up to look at her husband. He's sitting perfectly still and has gone quite pale. "I'm sorry." Larry looks completely shocked. Of course he's shocked. He would never expect this of her. She closes her eyes.
"How could you?" he says.
"I'm sorry," she repeats miserably, opening her eyes. Larry looks pointedly at the two police detectives and says,
"Maybe you'd better leave." "I'm afraid we have some questions before we go," Webb says.
Becky turns bitter, resentful eyes on the detective and waits. She doesn't want to help them.
"We talked to Paul Sharp," he says.
Becky remembers what she told these same detectives that morning. She thinks uneasily of Olivia.
"Paul?"
Larry interjects in surprise. It occurs to her suddenly that maybe Larry knew about Paul and Amanda. Becky says, "Paul was seeing Amanda."
"We don't know that," Webb says mildly.
She turns on him. "Did he deny it?"
"Yes, he did," Becky snorts.
She knows what she saw.
"He admitted speaking to her that night in her car," the detective says. "But he said he was warning her off. He believed she was having an affair with a colleague at work, and he was telling her to back off."
Webb is looking at her husband as he says this.
"A likely story," Becky says sarcastically, expecting her husband to back her up.
But Larry says nothing at all. Webb continues.
"In fact, he told us that he believed Amanda was having an affair with your husband. Isn't that right, Larry?"
Becky looks at her husband, stunned. Now Larry is shaking his head, slowly, back and forth, frowning.
"No, I wasn't having an affair with her. I can't believe Paul told you that."
Becky's mind is spinning. They're all watching Larry.
"It's not true," Larry protests. "I wasn't sleeping with Amanda."
He looks at the rest of them defiantly.
"Why would he tell us that if it wasn't true?"
Webb asks. Larry glances at them all nervously.
"The fact is, Paul thought I was having an affair with Amanda. He spoke to me about it. I denied it because it wasn't true. I thought he believed me. I can't believe he spoke to Amanda about it."
"Why would he think you were having an affair with Amanda, even after you denied it?" Webb asks. "Any idea?"
Becky catches something sarcastic in the detective's tone.
"You have to understand what Amanda was like," Larry begins, sounding defensive. "She was very attractive. She sometimes worked at our office as a temp. She could be inappropriate. She was in my office one day, and she was behaving improperly, and Paul saw it."
"You're gonna have to spell it out for us, Mr. Harris,"
Webb says, and stares at Larry until he squirms. Larry admits reluctantly, his face coloring with embarrassment,
"She was performing oral sex."
"On you?"
"Yes."
Becky stares at her husband, speechless.
"Paul saw it," Larry explains. "He drew the obvious, but entirely incorrect, conclusion. He confronted me, and I told him I wasn't seeing her. He didn't believe me. I didn't think he'd go so far as to warn her off. I mean, that's just ridiculous. There was nothing going on. It was just that one time. That's just what she was like."
Becky wonders if her husband is telling the truth. She realizes that she has no idea. Suddenly, she doesn't feel so contrite, so ashamed. Maybe her husband had his hand in the cookie jar, too. She watches the two detectives, trying to get a read on what they're thinking. She can't tell.
"Yes," Webb says. "Sharp told us about that. In detail."
Becky watches her husband's face flush.
"That's all it was, I swear, that one incident. I wasn't seeing Amanda. I knew her from her temping at the office, and they live next door, but we didn't have much to do with them. I think we had drinks with them once or twice," he adds. "I don't know what happened to her."
"Where were you the weekend that Amanda disappeared?" Webb asks.
You can't be serious,
Larry protests. Webb just looks at him and waits. Becky is staring in alarm at her husband. He glances at her.
I was away that weekend, and when I got back, I heard that she was gone and that her husband had reported her missing, but it was generally believed that she'd packed a bag and left him.
He adds, I was at a conference from Friday afternoon to Sunday afternoon. He looks up at them.
I wasn't even here.
Where was the conference held? Webb asks.
At the Deerfields Resort.
And where's that, exactly?
It's a couple of hours from here, in the Catskills.
You don't say, Webb says. Chapter 18. Olivia can tell that something is bothering her husband. He was restless the night before, tossing and turning through the night. When she asked him if something was wrong, he denied it. Perhaps he is simply worried, like she is, about Raleigh, waiting for the cops to show up at their door. She's upstairs in her office the next morning when the doorbell rings. She freezes. She's afraid it's that woman, Carmen, back again. She hurries to the front window in the upstairs bedroom and looks out, but she can't see who is at the door. The doorbell rings again. She waits. The doorbell rings a third time. Whoever it is isn't going away. Finally, she steels her nerves and goes downstairs. She's determined to put a brave face on things and completely deny anything Carmen says. She's angry enough that she thinks she can do it. She opens the door and is completely surprised to see her friend Becky standing on her doorstep. She'd last seen Becky at book club on Monday night. Now it's Friday morning, and there's something about Becky's wary expression that puts Olivia on guard. And she looks like a mess. Her hair is neglected, and she's not wearing her usual lipstick. Becky, Olivia says, and then, is something wrong? Becky nods and says, can I come in? Of course, Olivia says. Come have coffee with me. They make their way automatically to the kitchen. Olivia pours two cups of coffee from the carafe. What is it? Something's obviously upset you. Becky sits down at the kitchen table.
This is really awkward, she says.
Olivia sets the coffee mugs on the table and sits down. She wonders if Carmen has been talking to Becky. She steels herself again. What is it?
It's about the investigation. About Amanda.
Olivia recalibrates. Not Raleigh, then. She feels a sense of relief, at least for herself, but she feels concerned for the woman sitting across from her. Why is Becky here?
The police came back to talk to me yesterday, Becky says.
Okay, Olivia says, taking a sip of coffee.
Oh, God, I don't know how to tell you this.
Just tell me, Becky. Olivia can feel her anxiety climbing. Becky grips her coffee cup with both hands. She finally looks Olivia in the eye and says,
I saw Paul with Amanda before she disappeared.
Olivia is stunned. Whatever she was expecting, it wasn't this. What?
I saw Paul with Amanda in her car one night, shortly before she disappeared. It looked like they were fighting.
Olivia says, Paul didn't know Amanda.
I know what I saw, Becky says carefully.
You must be mistaken, Olivia says coldly.
He would have told her,
wouldn't he? Becky says woodenly,
I'm not mistaken. Paul's admitted it to the detectives.
Olivia feels her insides turn. She's suddenly lightheaded. Paul has spoken to the detectives?
What do you mean? She asks. When did he talk to them?
She feels like she's standing on the edge of a cliff, and all Becky has to do is give her a gentle push.
Becky shifts uneasily in her chair. Yesterday, they went to his office. They talked to him there.
How do you know that? Why would they go see him? She's trying to make sense of what Becky is saying.
Because when they questioned me about Amanda, I had to tell them that I'd seen Paul with Amanda in her car, she adds. I didn't want to tell them.
He never said anything to me about the detectives, Olivia whispers in shock.
I'm sorry,
Becky says, and sits quietly, as if waiting for Olivia to put it together.
You think Paul might have been seeing Amanda?
Olivia asks in disbelief, sitting perfectly still.
That's impossible.
But she thinks of Paul. tossing and turning all last night. Apparently, he'd spoken to the detectives earlier that day. What else has he kept from her? She can feel herself starting to tremble. A darkness passes before her eyes, like a shade, and she grips the edge of the table. Was Paul cheating on her? She's never suspected him of being unfaithful, ever. But now another realization hits her. If Paul was having an affair with Amanda, he will be a suspect in her murder. She remembers him reading the article in the newspaper, his feigned lack of interest in the case. Her stomach churns. Becky says,
"He admitted to being in the car with her, but he denied having an affair with her."
Olivia stares at Becky. She has to know what the hell is going on. "How do you know? Why was he in the car with Amanda? I don't understand." Becky says, carefully,
"He told the detectives that he thought she was having an affair with Larry, and he was telling her to stay away from him, but I'm sorry, that's just not true."
"You're Larry?" Becky nods. Olivia is astonished. "Why are you so sure Larry wasn't having an affair with her, and you're suggesting that Paul was?" Olivia protests. Becky leans closer toward her over the kitchen table.
"I don't know if Paul was having an affair with Amanda, but I saw them together and I had to tell the detectives."
Olivia says, "Why would Paul say that about Larry if it wasn't true?" Becky sits back in her chair and folds her arms across her chest.
"You remember what Amanda was like. Remember her at that party? Oozing sex appeal, basking in all the male attention. Apparently, it was worse at the office, and Paul caught her behaving inappropriately with my husband once, but he says it meant nothing."
"Behaving inappropriately how, exactly?"
"I don't know the details," Becky says, averting her eyes.
"I can't believe that Paul was seeing Amanda," Olivia says.
"Well, I don't believe Larry was either."
She reaches for her coffee cup.
"Maybe it's all just a misunderstanding. Perhaps Paul misinterpreted the situation and overreacted."
"So what? Now the detectives are investigating Paul and Larry?" Olivia asks in disbelief. Becky nods uneasily.
"And what do they think?"
"I don't know. They never say what they think, but they spoke to Paul yesterday and came to our house last night after Larry got home and accused Larry of having an affair with Amanda. He denied it."
Becky turns her face away and looks bleak.
"We had the most awful argument after."
Part of Olivia wants to comfort Becky, but another part of her hates Becky for bringing all this into her house and dumping it in her lap. She thinks about the argument she and Paul will have that evening. She doesn't believe that Paul was sleeping with Amanda, but he's obviously not telling her everything either. If he thought Larry was having an affair with Amanda, why didn't he tell her? Why didn't he tell her the police had come to his office yesterday?
"I thought you should know what was going on," Becky says, "in case Paul didn't tell you."
Olivia recoils as if from a slap. Does Becky expect her to thank her? Now Becky is staring down at the kitchen table.
"There's something else. I probably shouldn't tell you this, but it's probably not going to stay secret for long. And I need to talk to somebody, and I don't want you to think I've been lying to you."
Becky seems so distraught now that Olivia feels a sudden twinge of sympathy for her. But what she feels most is a sense of foreboding. What more can there possibly be?
"What?" "It's about Robert Pierce."
Olivia sits back. She could tell, even at book club, that Becky had a bit of a thing for him. He's very attractive and lives right next door to her. Larry is away a lot. Her children go to school out of town. "What about him?"
"I slept with him when Larry was away,"
Becky confesses, looking up at her.
"Twice."
Olivia just stares, shocked, into silence.
"I must have been out of my mind," Becky admits. "But there was this chemistry between us. I don't know what came over me. I just couldn't resist him."
"My God, Becky, he probably killed his wife."
"He didn't. I'm sure he didn't."
"How can you be so sure?"
Olivia says, aghast. If people were aware of what Amanda was like, if Paul thought she was sleeping with Larry, even if it wasn't true, then her husband must have had some idea what she was like. He might have been jealous, angry. She adds firmly, "He's probably the one who killed her." Becky says, shaking her head,
I don't think he did it. I don't think he could kill her. I think it was someone else.
Who then?
I don't know. Some stranger. Someone we don't know. Paul and Larry had nothing to do with it.
Of course they didn't, Olivia says. I still think it was her husband.
Robert Pierce looks coldly across the interview table at the two detectives who have become such a nuisance to him. When Detective Webb called him at home a short while ago, asking him if he'd be willing to come down to the station to answer a few more questions, he considered his position carefully before he answered. He suspected that if he refused, they would simply arrive at his door and place him under arrest. So here he is. He knows they suspect him of murder, even if they won't say so. He must convince them otherwise. "Am I under arrest?" he asks.
"No," Detective Webb says. "You know you're not."
"Then why does it feel that way?"
"You can leave at any time," Webb says.
Robert doesn't move. Webb leans back in his chair and asks, "Did you know your wife was having an affair?"
Robert eyes him warily.
"No, I told you that."
"Were you aware that your wife had a reputation for flirting, for cheating?"
Robert feels his face darken but remains calm.
"No, I certainly wasn't aware of it. But she was a very attractive, very confident woman. People will talk."
"Yes, they do talk."
Detective Webb leans forward and says,
"We spoke to a number of people who worked where Amanda was a temp, some of the places she temped regularly. One of those was Fanshawe Pharmaceuticals."
"Yes, she liked working there."
"People there said she had a reputation," the detective says.
Robert stares back at him, refusing to rise to the bait.
"A reputation for having sex in elevators, for instance,"
Moen says. He glares at her silently.
"In fact," Webb says, "we think we know who was having an affair with your wife."
Robert remains silent for a few seconds and then shrugs and says, "It's possible. I told you. I don't know what to think since I found out she lied to me about going away with Caroline. Maybe she was having an affair." He leans forward now himself. "But if she was, I didn't know about it."
"You absolutely sure about that?"
Webb asks.
"Yes, I trusted Amanda," Pierce says, leaning back again in his chair.
"And yet you cheated on her with your neighbor," Moen breaks in. He fixes a hard look on her. He finds her annoying, picking away at him.
"That was a moment of stupidity. Becky came on to me. I shouldn't have done it. Just because I did something wrong, it doesn't mean my wife did."
"Doesn't it?" Moen asks, arching an eyebrow. He doesn't like her. He doesn't like either one of them. He considers getting up and leaving. He knows he's within his rights to do so. He's here voluntarily.
Moen continues to goad him.
"You haven't asked who was having an affair with your wife."
"Maybe because I don't want to know," Robert says bluntly.
"Or maybe it's because you know already,"
Webb suggests. Robert gives the detective a hostile look.
"Why would you say that?"
"We think she was sleeping with your neighbor, Larry Harris."
He is suddenly furious, but tries to tamp down his anger.
"I didn't know."
"Sure you didn't," Webb says pleasantly. "That's not why you slept with Becky Harris, is it? To get back at your wife's lover? You wouldn't do that, would you? Just like you wouldn't kill your wife."
Chapter 19. Glenda waits in the bean for Olivia. She's late. Glenda glances at her watch again and wonders what's keeping her. It's not like Olivia to be late for anything. Finally, she arrives, flustered, and approaches. Glenda has deliberately chosen a table where they can't be overheard. Looks like maybe that's a good thing. Olivia sits down. She's obviously upset.
"What's wrong?" Glenda asks.
"You have to promise me you won't tell anyone what I'm about to tell you," Olivia says nervously. "Not even Keith."
Glenda sits up straighter.
"Of course, I promise. I don't tell Keith a lot of stuff we talk about anyway. What is it?"
Olivia lowers her voice and says, "Becky Harris seems to think Paul might have been having an affair with Amanda."
Glenda feels a shock run along her spine. She stares at Olivia in dismay. Why would she think that? As Olivia explains, Glenda tries to process everything she's hearing about Olivia's earlier conversation with Becky. But it's hard to square with the man she's known for years. Paul wouldn't cheat on you, Glenda says. I simply don't believe it.
Me neither, Olivia says, her voice fraught with emotion. But why isn't Paul telling me these things? Why didn't he tell me he spoke to Amanda? Why didn't he tell me he thought Larry was having an affair with her? Why didn't he tell me he was questioned by the police?
Glenda hears the growing hysteria in Olivia's voice.
I don't know, she says uneasily. I thought we had a solid marriage. We're honest with each other. I can't believe he's been keeping these things from me.
If Paul told the police he thought Larry was sleeping with Amanda and he was warning her off, I believe him, Glenda says firmly. I think it's much more likely that Larry was cheating on Becky than that Paul was cheating on you, don't you? Olivia nods. She seems relieved to hear someone else say it.
Actually, I probably shouldn't even tell you this, but...
What?
Becky confessed to me that she slept with Robert Pierce before Amanda disappeared.
Now Glenda is truly shocked. She certainly wasn't expecting this. Finally, she says, well, well, there you go. There are obviously problems in that marriage. Then she leans anxiously over the table. Listen, Olivia, you don't want the police to think Paul might have been seeing Amanda. Then he might be a suspect in her murder. You don't want that. You don't want them snooping into your life.
It's too late, Olivia says miserably. I think Paul is already a suspect. I think Becky already told them her suspicions about Paul and Amanda.
Glenda says quickly, well, you have to make sure that they drop that idea fast. Tell them he was with you all weekend.
He probably was with me all weekend.
So that's okay then. Olivia says, clearly tense,
I have to talk to him tonight when he gets home. I'll ask him why he didn't tell me about any of this, and I'll ask him straight out if he told the police the truth.
Glenda nods. Let me know what he says. Now she notices Olivia looking at her more closely, as if noticing for the first time how tired she is. Glenda knows there are dark circles under her eyes. She'd studied herself in the mirror this morning.
How are things with you? Olivia asks.
Not good, Glenda admits. Adam seems to hate his father.
Why?
Olivia asks. I don't know, Glenda says, looking away. They clash constantly. I suppose it's normal for teenage boys to clash with their fathers. They have to separate themselves, stand on their own. She pauses. Mind you, he doesn't seem to like me much better these days. After they part, Glenda walks home, thinking more about what Olivia has told her. Surely Paul wouldn't cheat on Olivia. She's known them for 16 years. But she's uneasy. She remembers what Amanda was like, the one time she ever really saw her at the party last year. It was a warm, sunny day in September. Amanda was wearing a short, yellow sundress, showing off her sleek, tanned legs. Her toenails were perfectly painted, and she was wearing high-heeled sandals. Glenda and Olivia had stopped wearing short sundresses a long time ago. Now they wore capri pants and flat sandals and talked about getting the veins in their legs fixed. But Amanda was young and beautiful and had never had children, so her legs were perfect, like the rest of her. Glenda remembers how she kept leaning forward, casually showing off a bit of perky breast and lacy bra every time she spoke to Keith or Paul or Larry or any of the other men who had been there. Had she paid particular attention to any of the men that day? She didn't think so. But they'd all made fools of themselves. Amanda had flirted with each of them, holding court like a southern belle, while her own husband sat back and said little, drinking beer and watching her indulgently. Amanda would occasionally turn to her quiet, handsome husband and clasp his hand in hers, silently acknowledging that she belonged to him. At the time, Glenda thought he'd seemed proud of her. But now she wonders, is that how it was? Or was he annoyed with her? With the attention she was attracting, and the attention she was paying to everyone but him. Was he angry and jealous, and hiding it? Did he worry that she might be unfaithful? Every marriage has its secrets. Glenda wonders what theirs were.
When Paul arrives home from work, Olivia is waiting for him. Raleigh's gone out for basketball practice. It will give them a chance to talk. She hears him come in the front door and moves from the kitchen to the hall to confront him. She immediately notices how worn out he looks. In fact, he looks like hell. She doesn't have much sympathy.
"We need to talk," she says. Her voice is tight.
"Can I take off my coat first?" he snaps. He reads her face and says, "Where's Raleigh?"
"Raleigh's at practice. He'll be home later."
He walks past her and into the kitchen. She follows him and watches as he reaches into the cupboard for the bottle of scotch. Olivia says, unable to keep the anger out of her voice,
"I know you've been talking to the police."
"So they came and talked to you, did they?" he says, with an edge to his voice. "Why am I not surprised?" He pours himself a drink and turns to look at her, leaning against the kitchen counter.
"No, they didn't come here. Becky told me."
"Ah, Becky," he says bitterly and takes a deep gulp.
"What the hell is going on, Paul?"
Olivia asks desperately. "I'll tell you what's going on if you're sure you want to know." He takes another sip of his drink. "Larry Harris had something going on with Amanda Pierce for ages. I finally confronted him about it, but he denied it. So I told Amanda to back off. Then she disappeared. I didn't mention it to the police at the time because I honestly didn't think it was relevant, and nobody asked. Everybody thought she'd just left her husband, but now? Apparently, Becky saw me talking to Amanda and stuck her nose in and told the police. So I had to tell them everything." He snorts. "I'll bet she's sorry she ever mentioned it." He lifts his head and looks tiredly at Olivia. "Now they're all over me, asking me for an alibi." He lifts his glass high and tosses back the rest of his scotch.
"Asking you for an alibi," Olivia echoes.
"Oh, I imagine they're asking Larry, too," Paul says. She has to ask.
"Tell me the truth," Olivia says. She can feel her voice catching. "Were you having an affair with Amanda or not?"
He looks at her, and something in his demeanor changes. The bristling anger falls away.
"Hell no, Olivia. I wasn't sleeping with her, I swear. I've never cheated on you. I wouldn't. You know that." "Then why didn't you tell me about this? Why all the secrets? You spoke to the police yesterday, and you didn't even tell me."
He hangs his head. "I'm sorry." She waits. He says, "I didn't tell you at the time about Larry because I wanted to keep it just between him and me. I know you and Becky are friends. I didn't want to put you in that position of knowing and wondering whether you should tell her. I thought if I told Amanda to back off, she'd stop carrying on with Larry. I didn't think their fling was important to her."
"How do you know she was seeing Larry?"
"I'd suspected it for weeks, but then I caught her giving him a blowjob in his office." Olivia is shocked. She wonders if Becky knows the details. Paul continues, "I told the detectives everything. It wasn't so much that I was worried about Larry's marriage, it's not really my business, but I was worried that he was getting careless and that somebody other than me would see them at the office and he'd lose his job. I didn't want that to happen."
Olivia can feel the tightness in her shoulders slowly starting to relax. "But why didn't you tell me yesterday after you'd spoken to the police? Why did you keep that from me?"
He shakes his head. "I don't know. I just didn't know what to do. I should have told you. I'm telling you now." He sighs and adds uneasily, "They asked me if I had an alibi for the weekend Amanda went missing."
"What did you tell them?" Olivia asks.
"I told them the truth, that I was home all weekend. I told them that we probably stayed in and watched something on Netflix. That's what we usually do. When was the last time we went out on a Friday or Saturday night?"
She thinks back to that weekend. Then she says,
"No. You went to your aunt's that Friday, remember?"
He freezes.
"Shit, you're right. I forgot.
You called me from the office and said you thought you'd better go see her."
"Yes," Paul says. "Fuck." She remembers that evening. Paul had gone to his aunt's and she'd stayed home and watched a movie by herself.
"You'd better tell them," Olivia says anxiously.
He nods. "I will. They're probably going to want to ask you, too."
"Ask me?"
"About where I was that weekend."
Why does it matter where you were? Olivia says, frustrated with the situation. You weren't involved with Amanda. Larry was. Paul snorts.
I don't think the police know who to believe.
After a moment, he says,
Can we call it even?
What do you mean?
You know, you didn't tell me about those letters.
She'd forgotten all about the letters. They've been pushed from her mind by everything else that has been going on. She approaches him, puts her hands on his chest. Yes. She can smell the scotch on his breath.
When did you say Raleigh was getting home again?
He says, wrapping his arms around her and giving her a kiss. Not for a while yet, Olivia says. Why don't you pour me a drink? As he pours her one, Olivia says, You don't think Larry could have had anything to do with...
No, of course not,
Paul says. Chapter 20 Becky wanders restlessly around the house Friday evening, waiting for Larry to get home from work. The way they left things the night before, he won't be in a good mood when he gets home. He said he'd probably be late. He always has a lot to catch up on after a business trip. Last night, she slept in the guest room. She's not sure how the two of them are going to move forward. Maybe they won't. Maybe their marriage is over, and all that remains is to find some way to tell the kids and figure out how to divide the spoils. In spite of her staunch denial to Olivia, she spends a lot of time wondering if Larry's insistence that nothing of consequence had happened between him and Amanda could possibly be true.
It's been a long day, a long week since they'd found Amanda Pierce's body, and Webb is feeling it. His eyes are burning and his limbs are tired. He's frustrated with the lack of progress on the case, but a picture has begun to emerge. They'd spoken to others at Fanshawe Pharmaceuticals when they'd finished with Paul Sharp and had formed a clearer idea of who Amanda Pierce really was. Webb wondered how much of the talk about her was true, but Larry has admitted to the incident in his office, so some of it is true at least. Now, Moen is driving them back from the Deerfields Resort, where Larry had attended a conference the weekend that Amanda was murdered. Webb stares out the window at the darkening scenery, reflecting on what they've learned. Larry Harris was certainly at the conference from Friday night until Sunday afternoon. Lots of people on staff confirmed that. He checked in at 3 p.m. on Friday. But after that, there's a gap. The bar staff and wait staff remember him, but none of them can remember with any certainty seeing him at the reception before 9 p.m. They agreed that he was one of the last to leave the event and make his way up to his room at the end of the night at around 11. There had been no sit-down meal where someone might have remembered him, just drinks and mingling in the ballroom. He could have arrived late to the reception, giving him several hours to meet and perhaps kill Amanda Pierce. Most damning of all, her car had been dumped in a lake not far from the resort. The rest of the weekend seems accounted for. He was registered in various sessions, and he was seen in those sessions throughout the weekend. But there is the tantalizing gap on Friday. Webb points his finger. Turn here. Moen turns off the highway and goes down a gravel road. It's almost dark already. It's been a miserable, wet day, but it's warm and cozy in the car. They're returning to the scene where Amanda's body was recovered. He's been timing it since they left the resort. Moen is driving a bit too fast for the gravel road. Slow down. We can estimate for speed later, Webb tells Moen. She lets up on the gas. The way is dark and winding. The car's headlights sweep around the bends in the road. Trees rise on each side. Some of the trees are almost bare already. The weather has turned, and it seems much longer than a few days since they were out here, lifting the leaking car out of the cold lake.
Are you sure you'll be able to recognize the spot in the dark? Moen asks, driving more slowly now. I'm not sure I could. I'm a city girl.
I hope so, Webb says, looking intently at the dark landscape beyond the windshield. We're getting close, I think. Slow down.
She slows the car around a curve and he says,
Here, I think this is it. Pull over.
He recognizes the curve in the road, the slope down to the beach, the edge of the lake. Moen pulls the car over and stops. She turns off the engine. Webb looks at his watch, glowing in the dark. 20 minutes. Moen looks at him, nodding. No time at all. For a moment, they sit in the dark. Then they get out of the warm car into the chill of the night. Webb stands by the car door, getting his bearings, remembering the previous Monday morning when they'd made their gruesome discovery. Where's the murder weapon? Webb asks. He walks down to the edge of the water and looks out over the lake. A sliver of moon emerges, sharp and bright from behind dark clouds. He tries to imagine what went on here. Who put the windows down? Whoever it was wore gloves, because there were no prints on the window buttons other than Amanda's. Who stuffed her body into the trunk and guided the car down the slope and into the water? Webb thinks the killer is quite likely someone they have already met. He turns to Moen. Her eyes are glinting in the dark. Whoever killed her was probably counting on her car, and her body, never being found at all, Webb suggests. He looks out again across the dark lake. Everyone thought she'd left her husband, and it's very hard to convict without a body. He glances again at Moen. Somebody must be squirming. For somebody? This hasn't gone according to plan. Becky hears the door downstairs open shortly after 9 p.m. She's upstairs in bed and cocks her head, listening. She'd grown tired of waiting for Larry and had eaten and gone up with a book. Now she listens to him wandering around downstairs. After a few minutes, she puts the book aside, pulls on her robe, and leaves the bedroom. She stops at the top of the stairs when she sees her husband standing at the bottom, looking up at her. Their eyes meet, but neither of them speaks for a moment. Then she says, "Where have you been?" She doesn't think he's been at the office this late. He doesn't answer her. Finally, Larry says, "We need to talk." She makes her way slowly down the stairs. He says abruptly, "I need a drink." He slouches over to the bar cart in the living room and pours himself a stiff shot of bourbon. "You might as well pour me one, too," Becky says. She walks over to him and he hands her a glass. They each take a sip. All the things he might say are swirling around in her head. She wonders how Larry must have felt when Amanda disappeared, and then when her body was discovered. Was he worried that the police would find out about him and Amanda, the way she'd worried that they would find out about her and Robert? He gives her a conciliatory look. "I had nothing to do with what happened to Amanda, and you know it." "Do I?" she says. He stares at her, clearly shocked. "You can't honestly think—" He continues to stare at her, as if unable to find words. "I don't know what to think," she says coldly. "And if I don't quite believe you, how do you think the police are going to see it?" As she stands there looking at him, this man she's been married to for 23 years, she allows herself for the first time to actually consider whether Larry might have killed Amanda Pierce. It gives her a chill. "You can't be serious." Then he laughs, a short, tight laugh. "Oh, I get it. You're already in divorce negotiations, is that it? You feel you have some leverage over me and you want to use it to your advantage?" She hadn't really thought of it that way, but now that he's mentioned it, she sees the possibilities. She doesn't really believe that he harmed Amanda, but it wouldn't hurt for him to think she does. She gave up her career. She spent her best years keeping house and raising children for this man, while he was out making a good living. She should get what's coming to her. She doesn't want to get shafted. "You absolute bitch," he says. She jumps a bit at his tone. It's so unlike him. Then she says, in a mild voice, "I'm not going to make things difficult for you, Larry, as long as you play fair with me." "Is that so?" he says. He comes closer and stares down at her. She can feel his breath in her face, smell the liquor. "I had nothing to do with Amanda's disappearance." It's like he can't say it. He can't say death. She stands her ground. "But were you seeing her?" Becky asks. "Tell me the truth. It wasn't just that one time in your office, was it?" She knows him. She knows he would want more. He can be greedy. He slumps down onto the sofa and looks weary all of a sudden. His shoulders sag. "Yes," he admits. We were seeing each other for a few weeks. It started in July.
He downs the rest of his drink in one long gulp. She feels her entire body go cold.
Where?
We went to a hotel on the highway outside of Aylesford. She stares at him in disbelief, swelling with incoherent rage.
You idiot, she whispers. They'll find out.
No, they won't, he says stubbornly, glancing up at her, and then shifting his eyes away again at the incredulous fury he sees there.
Of course they will. They'll go around to all the hotels and motels with photos of the two of you and ask the staff.
How can he think they won't find out? She feels sick with fear now, and it makes her realize that she does care. People get arrested for things they didn't do all the time. She cares enough not to want to see her husband dragged through a murder investigation. She can't let that happen to her and the kids. She watched The Staircase on Netflix. She saw what that did to that family. It's not going to happen to hers, she thinks rapidly. Maybe you should have told the police when they were here. It's going to be worse when they find out and you didn't tell them.
I was afraid to tell them. I couldn't think. This has all been such a shock.
He takes a deep breath.
Maybe they won't find out, he says.
He looks up at her, infected by her alarm. I had nothing to do with what happened to her. I didn't think our casual meetings meant anything. I thought she'd left him.
It doesn't matter, Becky says, forcing herself to calm down.
She can see that Larry is starting to go to pieces. She must remain calm. She has to think.
You couldn't have done it. You have a solid alibi.
She sits down on the sofa beside him.
You were at that conference.
She'd had a bad moment when the detectives were here, and she'd realized that the conference Larry had attended wasn't that far from where Amanda's body had been discovered. But he'd told the detectives that he'd been at the resort from Friday afternoon on, and it had reassured her. There would be people there who could confirm that, surely. But now she sees a terrible pallor come over him and feels the bottom drop out of her stomach.
What is it, Larry? What aren't you telling me?
I didn't kill her, I swear. But there's panic in his eyes. She recoils a little.
Larry, you're scaring me.
Her car was found near the resort, he says nervously. How he avoids it, she thinks. Her car, not her body. Like he can't face it. She brushes the troubling thought aside. But it doesn't matter, she insists. Not if you were at the resort the whole time. But now it crosses her mind. What if he snuck out for an hour or two? What if he'd arranged to meet her? Would he have been able to kill her then? Could he have? She feels frightened at the realization that she doesn't know.
But what if people don't remember seeing me? He says, shifting his gaze around the room.
He doesn't seem to want to look her in the eye.
Larry, what are you saying?
He finally looks at her in fear, imploringly, as if she can somehow help him, but she's afraid she can't help him.
Larry, she says anxiously, did you leave the resort?
No.
So what's the problem?
I checked in on Friday and went up to my room. I didn't feel like seeing anybody. I'd had an argument with Amanda the day before. She said she didn't want to see me anymore, and I was upset and exhausted. So I stayed in my room and did some work, and then I fell asleep. I didn't wake up till almost 9. I missed most of the opening reception.
She looks at him in disbelief and rage.
Long seconds tick by, the room utterly still but for the pounding of her heart. Then she says,
Are you telling me the truth?
Yes, I swear. Even I'm having a hard time believing that, she says. She realizes he has no alibi at all.
Where did you have the argument with Amanda?
She asks, the gorge rising in her throat.
Did anyone see?
It was over the phone.
What phone?
He looks away furtively. We used burner phones. She can't believe it. Her husband, the father of her children, with a burner phone, she asks furiously.
What happened to the phone?
I threw it from the bridge into the river.
Which bridge? When? Fuck! They might have cameras, you know.
He looks up at her, ghastly pale now.
The Skyway, on Sunday, on my way home from the resort. She'd broken it off. I figured I didn't need the phone anymore.
You stupid son of a bitch, she hisses, and walks away.
Chapter 21.
Robert Pierce sits alone in his darkened living room, sipping slowly from a glass of whiskey. He's thinking about Detective Webb and his sidekick, Detective Moen, and what they might think, what they might have. They can't have anything on him. They're fishing. They will certainly be looking at his next-door neighbor, Larry Harris, who was sleeping with Amanda. Robert doesn't understand what Amanda saw in him, but she'd always been attracted to older men. Oh, he knew. He's not stupid. He'd known about Larry for some time. Then he got into Amanda's secret phone. It wasn't that hard. He just Googled, "How to unlock Android lock screen without password." And once he did, how enlightening it turned out to be. Her calls, her texts, those two secret numbers. He called one of them, and a man answered. As soon as he heard the man's voice, he recognized it, because, after all, it was who he was expecting it to be. "Larry," Robert said. "Who is this?" Larry asked, clearly startled. "It's her husband, Robert." Larry had hung up the phone in a hurry. There wasn't any answer at the other number. It was this other number that concerned him more. The number that she sent those texts to, the ones sharing intimate, private details of their life together, the one saying that her husband was a psychopath. Those texts enraged him. She must have been able to warn him that her husband had her phone. And there were other things on that phone, too, that she hadn't sent to anyone that made him angriest of all, and even afraid. He thinks about Becky. By now she must know about Larry and Amanda, if those detectives are any good at all. He suspects that Becky's half in love with him. He hopes she keeps her mouth shut. It wouldn't do for the police to think he had a motive to kill his wife. If Larry Harris tells them about that phone call, Robert will simply deny it. There's no proof, no proof at all that Robert ever made that phone call. No proof that Robert knew about her affair. Her affairs. As long as Amanda's burner phone is never found, it must never be found. He thinks back to when they first moved here. That insufferable party that Amanda insisted on going to, sitting there watching her, so lovely, so unwittingly cruel. He wonders now if she'd made her selections that day, which ones she was going to screw. They'd only been married a year. How little he knew her then, her proclivities, her childish, inexplicable need to seduce older men, and how little she knew him then, the dark, cold center of his soul. But they'd gotten to know each other better. He knows that Becky and Larry are both home. There are lights on downstairs next door, even though it's very late. How he'd love to be a fly on that wall. Raleigh waits until everyone in the house is asleep. He pulls on his jeans, a t-shirt, and his dark hoodie, and carefully opens his bedroom door. He knows his dad's a heavy sleeper. It's his mother he's worried about. But he stands still outside his bedroom in the hall, and he can hear each of them snoring their separate, distinct snores. Relieved, he creeps down the stairs, careful not to make a sound. He pulls on his sneakers in the kitchen. He doesn't turn on any lights. He's used to operating in the dark. Quietly, he slips out the kitchen door to the garage where he keeps his bike. He puts on his helmet, flings his leg over the bike, and as soon as he leaves the garage, starts pedaling, fast, away from the house. He knows it's bad. Hacking into people's computers. He started hacking for the challenge. How can he explain that to someone who doesn't feel it? His parents wouldn't get it, but any fellow hacker would know exactly why he does it. It feels great. Hacking into someone else's system makes him feel powerful, like he has control over something. He doesn't feel like he has much control over his own life. He promised his parents and himself that he would stop, and he will. The risks are too great. This is his last time. He wouldn't be doing it at all if he didn't know for sure that the owners were away, and this time he's got a pair of latex gloves stuffed in his jeans pocket. He took them from the package his mom keeps in her cupboard of cleaning supplies. He's not going to take any stupid risks, and he's not going to leave any prints behind. Raleigh studies the house. It's a dark night, and the moon is covered by cloud. The light is on at the front of the house, and there's a light on upstairs, probably on timers. He knows this because they have a cat. And the local pet sitter, who has a sign on her car, has been stopping by and going into this house for the last few days. Raleigh's seen her every morning on his way to school. How stupid can people be, hiring a pet sitter with a sign on her friggin' car? It's like advertising that you're out of town, for fuck's sake. He'd tried to talk himself out of it, but he just couldn't resist. He wants to break into a house where he doesn't have to worry about the owners coming home after a dinner out. He wants to relax and take his time, dig a little deeper, try a couple of different things before he retires. Raleigh creeps around the back of the house. No one is watching. He studies the doors and windows carefully. No obvious sign of security. But the doors and windows are securely locked. He's been watching videos on YouTube, just in case. It's not as hard to break into a house as a typical homeowner might think. He reaches into his jeans pocket and pulls out his bank machine card. He slides it along the edge of the door where the lock is and starts to fiddle with the catch. The guys on YouTube do this in a couple of seconds, but it takes Raleigh almost a full minute before the catch gives way with a satisfying click. And just in time, he's sweating buckets, afraid someone might see him. He slips inside the door and closes it quietly behind him, his heart thumping. He puts his card back into his pocket and takes out his phone. He turns the flashlight on. The door opens directly into the kitchen. He kicks something, a dish, and sends it clattering across the floor. Shit. He points the light down. There's kibble everywhere. He squats down, sweeps it into a pile, and picks it up with his gloved hands. Now there's a black and white cat brushing against his shins. He stops to pat it for a minute. He doesn't waste time downstairs. The computers are almost always upstairs, in the bedrooms or the office. The house is obviously occupied by a couple with a baby. There's a master bedroom, a baby's room, and an office at the back. He slips into the office at the end of the hall and sets about getting into the computer. With a USB boot stick and a few keystrokes, he's created a back door and bypassed the passwords. After he has a quick look around, he's going to try something new. He's going to use this compromised computer to try to get into its owner's employer's network, if he's employed anywhere halfway interesting. Raleigh's feeling relaxed. The computer is at the back of the house, the blinds are drawn, nobody can see in. He can stay here all night if he wants to. He's engrossed in what he's doing when he hears a sound. Car doors slamming. He freezes. He hears voices outside. Fuck! They can't be home! Raleigh panics. He looks out the window. There's no way out there, no roof to climb out onto. He's not jumping out a second-story window. While he dithers, the voices get louder. Now he hears a key in the front door. Fuck, fuck, fuck! He's up out of the chair now and standing frozen in fear near the top of the stairs. Can he get down the stairs and out the back door fast enough? But the front door is opening now, and a switch is flicked on, flooding the front hallway with light. He's so screwed. There's no way out. He sees the cat enter the hall, brush against the leg of the hall table, and mew at her owners, but he can't see them. You take the baby up and put her down, and I'll bring in the gear, he hears a man's voice say. They still have no idea that there's a stranger upstairs in their house. Raleigh ducks back into the office at the end of the hall, barely daring to breathe. The computer is still on, but it faces away from the door and it's not making a sound. The room is dark. Maybe they won't notice. Maybe he can hide in here until they go to bed. He feels a bead of sweat trickle down his back. He hears a woman come heavily up the stairs, cooing to the baby. Raleigh wills it to start crying, but the baby stays quiet. The floorboards creak as the woman enters the baby's room in the middle of the hall. The husband is still outside with the car. Raleigh hears the trunk slam. Does he run for it now, or wait? It's the longest couple of seconds of Raleigh's life. He panics. He flees down the stairs as fast as he can, not even bothering to be quiet. He makes it to the bottom of the stairs before the man is at the front door. He hears the woman's startled cry behind him. He's halfway to the kitchen before the front door opens. He scrambles for the door in the kitchen, making his way in the dark, and kicks the cat dish again, sending it scattering. He hears the man behind him in the front hall, what the fuck? And hears him abruptly drop whatever he's carrying and come after him. Raleigh doesn't look back. He's out the door and running as fast as he can. He runs right across the backyard, hops the fence without even thinking about it, boosted on adrenaline. He doesn't stop until he's far away and his lungs are bursting.
He hides behind a bush in a park until his heart stops pounding and he gets his breath back. He still has to go back and retrieve his bike before he goes home. At least he'd have the sense not to leave it near the house. There's no way they won't call the police. They'll see that the computer is on and see what he's done.
Carmen can't sleep. She's tried reading, but nothing holds her interest. It's human company she wants. She misses her husband. He used to read in bed beside her. Now he's gone. She's downstairs in the kitchen making some hot chocolate when she hears something outside in the street, shouting. She freezes, listening. She hears banging, more shouting. She moves quickly to the front door but doesn't turn on the light. When she looks out, she sees a lean, dark figure weaving on the sidewalk at the end of her driveway. He appears to be alone. He's got something in his hand, a stick of some kind. She creeps forward, and as she gets closer, she sees that it's just a boy, a teenager, probably drunk on a Friday night. He's standing still now, swaying, as if he can't remember what he was doing, and he's got what looks like a broken hockey stick in his hand. She thinks he's been smashing her recycling bin. "Hey," Carmen says, striding down the driveway toward him in her pink bathrobe. The boy looks back at her, as if dumbfounded at the sight of her. "What are you doing?" she says crossly. She's not afraid of him, he's just a boy. She's only a few feet away from him now and can see him clearly. She can also smell the booze on him. Something about him reminds her of her own son, Luke. He seems to be trying to focus, but his face is slack. He doesn't say anything, but he doesn't run either, probably because if he tried, he'd fall flat on his face. "You're not old enough to drink, are you?" she says, the mother in her speaking. He waves her away like he's swatting a fly and stumbles on down the street, dragging his broken hockey stick. Concerned, she watches him stumble down the sidewalk until he turns into a house farther down the street. She sees lights go on in the house. At least he made it home, she thinks. His own parents can deal with him. The next morning, Saturday, Glenda calls Olivia and invites her to go for a walk. She wants to know what happened last night when Olivia confronted Paul. Glenda puts on a jacket and her walking shoes. It's a cold, crisp day, but at least the sun is shining again after yesterday's dreary rain. She closes the door behind her and begins to walk toward Olivia's house. Her mind is full. If only she could solve everybody's problems. If only all this stress would go away. Last night, their son, Adam, had come home drunk again. They'd given him a curfew, but he'd ignored it. They'd grounded him, and he'd snuck out of the house. Now they don't know what to do. "Maybe we just let him sow his wild oats," Keith had said this morning. "When he's tired of barfing in the morning, he'll straighten out." She'd glared at him angrily, with her arms folded across her chest. He hadn't stayed awake all night keeping an eye on their son to make sure he didn't choke to death. Keith slept just fine. Nothing seems to bother him. It's like he's coated with Teflon. Sometimes she wishes she could make her husband understand all the things she does, all the things she's done for their family. He doesn't appreciate her enough. He never will. He's oblivious. And she'd had to clean up the mess in the bathroom. "Make him do it," Keith had said unhelpfully, pouring himself a cup of coffee. She'd glanced in at Adam, moaning in bed, realized that wasn't going to happen, and did it herself. Now all she wants is to get out of the house, away from her husband and her son and the smell of barf, and talk to someone reasonable, someone who understands. She sees Olivia approaching her on the sidewalk and waves. Soon they are face to face and fall into step together. "Let's head for the park," Glenda suggests. On the way, she tells Olivia about the latest problem with Adam. As they walk together along the edge of the pond, Glenda says, "Sorry to vent. So, what happened last night? Did you talk to Paul?" She turns to look at Olivia and notices that she seems much less tense than she had the day before. Olivia nods. "I did." She lets out a big exhale and stops, looking out over the water toward the trees beyond. "He wasn't seeing Amanda. He caught her giving Larry a blowjob in the office and warned her off so that Larry wouldn't lose his job." "Wow," Glenda says. Olivia turns to her and laughs suddenly. It's crazy, isn't it?
Glenda shakes her head.
The things people do.
I don't think Paul and I have anything to worry about, but Becky, I wouldn't want to be in her shoes.
Olivia's expression sobers. If anyone was having an affair with Amanda, it's most likely to be Larry, don't you think?
Glenda feels herself relaxing. The walk outside, airing her own complaints, and hearing Olivia's news have all done Glenda good. She doesn't know what she'd do if she didn't have Olivia to talk to.
Glenda says, I don't imagine that marriage is going to last much longer.
They stand side by side, watching the swans. Finally, Glenda asks, her voice hesitant, Do you think Larry could have killed Amanda?
No, Olivia says, shaking her head. No way. Paul doesn't think so either.
My money's on Robert Pierce.
Chapter 22. Olivia leaves Glenda at the corner and heads back home, head lowered. Glenda seems very distressed lately. She's obviously worried sick about Adam. Olivia knows Keith isn't a very proactive parent, or even a particularly supportive one. He seems to be leaving all the parenting to Glenda, and it's a heavy weight to bear. Olivia is grateful that Paul isn't like that. They make decisions together, and they usually see things the same way. Except for sending Raleigh for therapy, of course. And the apology letters. As she approaches her own house, she sees a sedan parked out in front. Her eyes go to her front door, and she sees two people standing there, their backs to the street. Her heart begins to beat faster. She hurries up the driveway as Paul opens the door. She sees the startled look on his face. Then his eyes meet hers, and it seems to ground him. The man on the front step turns around and sees her.
Good morning, he says as she approaches. He shows her his badge. I'm Detective Webb. This is Detective Moen. Sorry to bother you on Saturday, but may we come in? We won't be long.
Olivia nods.
I'm Olivia, she says.
Come in,
Paul says, and pulls the door open wide.
I was just out for a walk, Olivia says, taking their coats. Can I get you anything? Coffee?
No, thank you,
Webb says, following her husband into the living room, Moen behind him. Detective Moen smiles back at her. She has a kind face, Olivia thinks. She's more likable than her partner, who seems rather abrupt. Maybe that's why they work together, Olivia thinks. She and Paul sit side by side, rather stiffly, on the sofa. Detective Webb turns to her.
As you probably know, he says, glancing at her husband, we're investigating the murder of Amanda Pierce.
Olivia tells herself to relax. They have nothing to hide. It's good that the detectives are here. They can immediately clarify where Paul was on that Friday night.
Yes, I know, Olivia says.
We've already spoken to your husband, and he's been very cooperative, the detective says.
Olivia nods. She still feels slightly nervous, but who wouldn't be nervous having police detectives in their living room?
I understand that he was home with you the evening of Friday, September 29th, Webb says.
Paul faces Detective Webb.
Actually, I was mistaken before. I completely forgot. I have an elderly aunt, my Aunt Margaret, who lives alone and gets quite lonely. She calls me a lot, asking me to visit. She called me that day, particularly agitated, and asked me to come see her, and I did. I went right after work. I called Olivia first to tell her.
He glances at her. Olivia nods.
That's right, she says.
Webb studies her for a moment, and then turns back to Paul.
Where does your aunt live?
He asks. Olivia sees Moen pull out her notebook, flip over a page.
She's in Berwick?
I see, Webb says. Olivia feels uneasy. She knows what the cop is thinking. The small town where Paul's aunt lives is in the direction of Canning, out where Amanda's body was found. But Paul didn't have anything to do with Amanda. What he says is true. Quite often, Margaret calls and begs him to visit. It's a pain, really. Mostly he doesn't, but sometimes he'll make the trek out there. He's not especially close to her, but there's no other family to visit her, and he feels guilty. She remembers that Friday. He told her that Margaret was being very demanding, that he hadn't been to see her in a long time, and that he felt he couldn't say no. The detective says,
You say she lives alone? That's right, Paul answers. She's on a list for assisted living, but her name hasn't come up yet. So, for now, she has people come in and help her. Was there anyone there with her when you visited her that Friday evening? Webb asks. Anyone who can vouch for you? Well, no. It was evening. They'd gone home. But if we make a visit to your aunt, she'll confirm that you were there that night? Now Paul looks uncomfortable. He shifts a little in his chair. Well, I don't know, he says. You see, her memory is going. She's got quite bad dementia, too, so she's liable to get a bit mixed up. She won't remember a visit from 3 weeks ago. I see. What number did she call you at? Detective Moen asks. She called my cell while I was at work, Paul says. She calls me quite a lot, actually. Pretty much every day. So if we were to check your cell phone records, it would show that she'd called you that day? Moen asks. Paul nods emphatically. Yes, of course. And if we were to check your whereabouts by the location of your cell phone that night, it would show you were at your aunt's, Webb says. Now Paul looks less sure of himself. He opens his mouth to speak, but says nothing. Is there a problem? Webb asks. Olivia watches all this unfold in front of her, her heart picking up speed. I don't know, Paul says. I had my cell phone with me, but it was very low on battery and I didn't have a charger with me, so I just turned it off. I see, Webb says. Paul glances nervously at Olivia. It doesn't look like the detective believes him. What time did you get home, Mr. Sharp? Webb asks. I'm not sure, Paul says, looking at Olivia. Around 11? Olivia shrugs. I honestly don't remember. I went to bed early. I was already asleep when you came in. She suddenly realizes that Paul won't actually be able to prove where he was that night. She studies the detectives, but she can't tell what they're thinking. She tells herself she has no reason to be worried, but she doesn't like the way they are looking at her husband. She feels a bit nauseated. She wonders, sickeningly, if he's got anything to hide. And the rest of the weekend? Webb asks, looking at Olivia. He was home.